Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. Arts and entertainment in our region as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll have music and conversation with Elizabeth Chan, who started a company dedicated solely to Christmas music, though she left a rather comfortable position to do so. That's coming up in just about 10 minutes or so. First, though, we have a look at a guide to a lot to do quite nearby.
You're listening to KVC Arts here on 91.9 KVCR. I'm Jessica Greenwell, and I am joined today by Larry Burns, author of the unique and helpful guide, 100 Things to Do in Riverside Before You Die. So before we explore the book, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and how you became inspired to write this?
Certainly. I became inspired to write this book mostly because of all of the things I've heard said about the Inland Empire and Riverside in particular over the last couple of decades. I've lived out here since 1994, and I grew up in the Inland Empire. So my purpose was to speak to the things that I cared about, the things that I saw in my community that were really cool, fun to do, art-focused, culturally relevant, and things that just people weren't really talking about too much outside of our area. So I wanted people to know about that, and I wanted to celebrate all of the great things that we had to offer.
So when you started hashing it out and coming up with ideas, did you find it challenging to hit 100, or was that your original goal, or how did that develop?
The original goal was to come up with the 100, and it was I thought it would be a little daunting at first, and then I totally wrote about 115 of them altogether, and then it was a matter of, okay, now which ones do I get rid of? And So that was a hard couple of days there, trying to figure out which ones don't I put in this list.
Right.
But I think I made some good decisions there. When I made those decisions, I was mostly thinking about what's going to be around in 5 years. I didn't want to have too many things in a book like this, and it's bound to happen. A few things are going to come and go, especially food. You know, restaurants don't always last as long as you'd hope. So trying to use that as a criteria, something that's been tried and true, something that is different and special. That's what I ended up going with.
So in the preface, you talk a little bit about the founders of the city and how they helped shape its design. So could you go into that a little bit?
Certainly. I was really surprised over the years just to see how much of a social justice mindset was in a lot of the founders of the city of Riverside. You know, people came out here because they wanted to create a better life for individuals and use the land in a way that they saw fit and profitably. And we had a wide, diverse group of people coming to this area. There was already indigenous people that lived here. Californios have been here for hundreds of years. But the newer members that were coming out here, that struggle between the existing communities and the new people coming out, I think was more successful in Riverside and other areas because the idea was to create these not utopian societies, but more free, open societies where regardless of your race, regardless of your gender, you could have some success. And you can see that in looking at the histories of our founders and, you know, particularly like people like Eliza Tibbetts. Mm-hmm. Those things were made possible because this was a progressive community even as far back as 100 years ago.
That's amazing how forward thinking they were then, you know, and developed these great urban landscapes and so many outdoor areas. That's one of the things I love about being a resident. There are so many parks and just neat places to explore. Were those included in the founding? Were a lot of those places established? Or
yes, they really were. They came about just because there was so much land in this area. And if you're in Riverside traveling around, you really find that it's an expansive area. It's really it's huge. It's, I think, 52 square miles. It's enormous and spread out, and it's got different feels in all different areas. And doing the research for this book and then comparing it to some other areas, I was really amazed at just how much open space we've preserved over the years. And those things are going to remain in perpetuity because they've been set up in such a way that they're not going to be developed. They're going to remain protected despite changes in political climates and ideas and values. I think one of the things that is going to stick with the community of Riverside is this dedication to open space so that in areas like Sycamore Canyon, which is the largest, you know, preserved open space in an urban area west of the Mississippi, that place is going to be there in 50 years for my grandchildren, God willing. They'll still be there to see what Riverside looked like 100 years ago.
I'm Jessica Greenwell. We are here talking about 100 Things to Do in Riverside Before You Die. I'm joined by Larry Burns. Let's dive into this. Over the last few years, the Festival of Lights has gained immense popularity. And since this event is happening right now, would you go ahead and tell us a little bit about it?
Certainly. One of the things that's been exciting to see it really grow over the last couple of years, and particularly this year with their 25th anniversary, yeah. they've really done it big, is to just talk about the scale of this place. You know, you hear from different people, there's a 2 million visitors, 4 million visitors. Yeah. 5 million lights this year.
Yeah, every year the lights go up.
Yes, and so you don't know. You got to check all these sources sometimes, and you got like, what's the real number? And it seems to be settling around 4.5 million lights. It always seems to be a little bit more, a little bit more.
So for someone who doesn't know what we're talking about right now, what is the Festival of Lights? Where is this taking place?
Festival of Lights takes place at the historic Mission Inn and Spa. Dwayne and Kelly Roberts restored that hotel in 1992. And soon after that began to start this Festival of Lights activity, which was designed to just celebrate the area and draw people to the community. And over the years, it's grown. It's expanded its footprint. More and more businesses and public areas have put items in there. Mm-hmm. The lights just go on everywhere. Frankly, it's a way that many people outside of Riverside experience the city for the first time, which I think is good. They see it at its best. They see it at its brightest.
Yeah.
They see it with plenty of entertainment downtown every single night. There's not a bad night to go check out Festival of Lights. You know, one of the reasons I wrote this book is because I wanted people to understand all of the great things, the commitment to arts and culture, mm-hmm. The innovative ideas, the do-it-yourself spirit that is Riverside, just exemplified with that. And that's another great example of something that starts small in Riverside and then just because of its popularity, because the community loves it, just keeps giving more and more to it every single year.
So besides the Festival of Lights, there's a lot of festivals that take place during the year in Riverside, many for adults, but a lot that are family-friendly as well.
That's true.
So what are some of those?
Goodness. In mid-January, you're going to have the Lunar Fest, which has been a long-running festival in the city of Riverside. This celebrates the varied Asian cultures that are on display all over the city of Riverside. Again, many people don't realize the cultural heritage and the Asian connection that Riverside has. But, you know, in our downtown area, we've got a statue to An Cheng Ho, which was a prominent member of the citrus community from Korea. We've got a Chinatown that we're trying to revitalize and sustain in the city of Riverside. And then, of course, we've got the Harada House, which is a cultural landmark. It's a national historic landmark. And it was part of some very important legislation and laws regarding the property rights of Japanese American citizens. Mm-hmm. And so to have something like that in Riverside, not to mention some of the other exhibitions and other special things like the Miniakuba display over at the Center for Social Justice and Civil Liberties. There's just many different examples of that Asian connection. So it makes sense that we do a big festival every single year to celebrate those things. So going on for the entire day, starting with a parade, and then there's martial arts demos going on all day. This year, I'm looking forward to the cosplay. They're inviting people to dress up in anime costumes, and which should be very popular with a lot of folks. So I'm looking forward to seeing that. That's probably the biggest thing I'm looking forward to in January is that the anime cosplay going on around me. I won't be dressed up.
You should.
Yeah, maybe I will.
Maybe you will.
It's a depend. Maybe I can get a cool idea from one of my sons. They could recommend something that doesn't make me look too old.
Oh, I'm sure whatever you pick, if you do, it'll be fun. Larry, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Jessica, thank you for having me. This has been a dream of mine. I've listened for years, and to actually see the insides of the studios is a real pleasure for me.
I'm Jessica Greenwell with Larry Burns talking about his book, 100 Things to Do in Riverside Before You Die. This is KVC Arts on 91.9.
And thank you, Jessica. For the remainder of the program now, we'll be starting to ease into the holiday season. We'll be speaking with Elizabeth Chan about her sixth CD released earlier this year. That's Songs for Noel, named for her daughter. We'll also hear about how she took quite a chance to get her company going. That's Merry Bright Music, a company solely dedicated to music of the Christmas season.
Hear the silver bells, hear them ring, 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 and the carolers, hear them sing, sing, sing. All around the world, we are gathering to greet a family that we've surely missed. Every boy and girl starts a brand new page. Now's the time to make a
I think what a person will read first about you, and one of the first things that I've told people is that you're an executive in a company, presumably well paid and secure, who quit her job and has now written 1,000 Christmas songs. There's the abbreviated version that I throw at people. Is that fact, legend, lore?
That's fact. And okay. I'm also a Billboard charting exclusively Christmas artist. Right now, I think my fourth or fifth single is about to be top 20 on the AC Billboard charts, and I have the number 8 holiday record in the country.
And how did this start, or why did this start? What kind of a position was it that you left to start Mary Bright?
I was an executive producer and director of marketing at Condé Nast Publications. So I worked in magazines, and I had worked across all of the biggest titles, like Teen Vogue and Self Magazine and Golf Digest and all the big magazines. So it was something that I had done for a while. I guess why Christmas is quite simple. I think you become the person that you're going to be by the time you're 7 years old. And for me, I knew at a very young age that I loved Christmas music and I wanted to write Christmas music as a child. I still have these journals of Christmas poems and poems about snow and all the things that come with the holiday season. I just have all this evidence and artifacts of my life as a 7-year-old and how much I loved Christmas music, and it never escaped my heart at all. Whenever I was having a very bad day in my career or at work, I would always go back to this fantasy that it would be great if I could just write Christmas music for a living. But anytime I would share that with my family and friends, they would think that I was kind of crazy because yes, there's no such thing, right? There's no company that I could apply for a Christmas music writing job. I mean, the last person that I can think of that had done such a thing would be like Burl Ives or Irving Berlin. So, you know, for me to say that in this day and age, that this is what I wanted to do, was just unfathomable to people. And sometimes the road less traveled is the best road.
Absolutely. Well, even though with folks like Irving Berlin, it's a nice one to throw out there, but he was doing music beyond just Christmas.
That's true. We just happen to know him for Christmas.
Yeah. So
I feel like a lot of composers and some of the greatest Christmas songwriters of our time accidentally fall into Christmas music, like Trans-Siberian Orchestra.
Oh, yes.
Or even Mariah Carey, right?
No.
I'm going to call a spade a spade. I've studied the history of Christmas music in the last 6 years that I've been doing this professionally. I study it because I want to know how can I make a standard. And, you know, she didn't even want to work on her Christmas record. She was forced into it by her then husband at the time, Tommy Mottola. So it wasn't something that was really a personal lifelong goal or accomplishment. You know, it was just something that she was told to do. Yeah.
Wow. But now the thing is with you, this is actually a passion. That will change the delivery and the product, for lack of a better word at this point.
Dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh. All the fields we go, laughing all the way.
Did you find yourself then, while you were at work, you said you would revisit your journals, or at least these thoughts and fantasies, when you were having bad days at work. Did you pretty much continue to take notes on what is going to be a good Christmas song day, or some phrase catches you in the middle of work and then, ooh, you have to write that one down?
No. No, I think for a long time I quelled that voice in my head that said, let's do Christmas music. I think everybody can relate to it. It may not be Christmas music, but there may be something that people always think about. And if it's something that you can't stop in your head, then you should absolutely go for it. I don't know if that makes any sense, but I feel like everybody has their own Christmas music in their heart that they want to accomplish. But life gets in the way, and, you know, work gets in the way, and then your bills get in the way, or your family gets in the way, or your friends get in the way, or something gets in the way. And all of that noise covers the true voice of your passion. And so I think, for me, I let my life kind of cover that voice for so long that it took me really having this, like, very pivotal moment in my career where I knew I was so categorically unhappy in my job at the time. But I couldn't figure out a way to escape. I mean, no matter how unhappy I was at my job, everything looked fantastic on paper. I had a great salary. I had a great office. I was married. I lived in the biggest city in the world. Nothing could make anyone else feel like I should just walk away from it, except for me. Like, I knew in my heart that the time that I was toiling away at my job was time that was killing me from not being able to do something for myself in my own lifetime. You have a certain amount of money that you know you need to live a certain amount of days. You have a certain amount of days to make a certain amount of money, but you never know how many days you have. And I think I hit a point in my life where I realized if I don't try to work towards my own passions in my lifetime, I'm going to look back and highly regret it. And for me, that was Christmas music.
I'm David Fleming in conversation with Elizabeth Chan. She has several holiday CDs out, her sixth and newest release out just this year, Songs for Noel. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. We're talking about Christmas music and Christmas CDs that people can purchase, but gosh, we're really talking about passions and following your dreams.
Yeah.
This is a great Christmas story. Anyway, yeah. I mean, people can put their kids to bed with this one.
It's perfect timing for New Year's resolution time, you know?
Oh, my God, yes.
You only have, like, 6 days to decide your New Year's resolutions by Christmas Eve, right?
Oh, yeah. It's a week of gluttony and then quick decisions.
Exactly.
Oh, my gosh. Let's look briefly at your latest work, Songs for Noel. Now, I have to say, if you just hear the title, it already screams Christmas tradition, Songs for Noel. But talk about why the spelling is different than one's traditional Noel, and I guess your early Christmas present, namesake.
Exactly. So this time last year, while I was on tour, I found out that I was going to be a mom for the first time. So where I was so used to putting out Christmas songs this year, I thought my album would be called Songs for Noel. And I had a little bit of help from my friends and my fans on Facebook. I gave them a few album title ideas, and they unanimously voted for Songs for Noel. Noel is the name of my newborn daughter. Well, she's not so newborn anymore. She just turned 6 months over the weekend. And when I recorded the album, I was 7.5 months pregnant, but I had already conceptualized and curated the album with her in mind. That was even before I knew that she would love music so much. She just loves music so much. And she's only 6 months old, so it's an extraordinary journey to just be a mom and write Christmas music. Think of too many Christmas composers that have that kind of experience. I think some of the best standards written to date, mostly by men. So those are my contemporaries, the Christmas composers. So I can't think of any woman Christmas composer that kind of has that perspective on Christmas music. Maybe Kelly Clarkson, maybe.
Never really thought of her as a Christmas composer. I guess, yeah, she did do that. I think of her as one of the American Idol people. Okay.
I owe my career to Kelly Clarkson, honestly.
Really? Tell me about this.
I owe it to her, and it's a long story, but...
Go for it. I'm recording.
So when I first started writing Christmas music, because I didn't know what I was doing and there was no guidebook, so people who I thought were smarter than me told me exactly how to get it done. And the way to get it done was to place a Christmas song on someone more famous than me's album. And so one of the first projects that I got to submit songs for was for Kelly Clarkson. And I got really excited. She said that she wanted seven different songs for me, and I submitted seven different songs, and I waited for a week and I didn't hear back, and I waited for another week and I didn't hear back, and I got an email that said that they were going to pass on all the songs because they weren't hits.
Oh.
Yeah, and so I thought that that was the end of my run, because everyone had told me that was the only way to make Christmas music, was to get someone more famous than me to record it.
Right.
And so, you know, I was going to take my ball and go home, but someone that was a mentor to me at the time, Steve Lillywhite, he's this famous producer who worked with U2 and Dave Matthews Band. He said that, you know, Elizabeth, sometimes A&Rs don't really know what they're talking about, and you have great songs, and I think they're hits, and I think you should just put them out yourself. And I was like, what do you mean, put them out myself? He's like, I think you should just, you know, maybe start a Kickstarter and put out the music yourself. You look okay. You can sing. Just put it out yourself as your own artist. And I was like, what? So, like, it took a leap of faith, and I so badly wanted to get these songs out there that I ended up being this artist that I never intended to be.
Gosh.
And later that year, that same season, the songs that I had prepared for Kelly, one of them ended up being right next to her on the Billboard chart. exactly. So that is what really started my professional Christmas music career.
Wow. And that became Naughty and Nice.
What child is this who lay to rest on Mary's lap is sleeping, whom angels greet?
Back to the songs for Noel for just a bit. You mentioned that you were 7 months pregnant when recording this, and I read that she would sometimes kick during the recording sessions. And
yeah.
So the first thing that I thought of, any chance of a note that came out differently because there was a kick that we could actually go back to and hear on the recording?
No, there isn't, because she would kick when I was producing the string arrangements. So she loved the string arrangements. I guess the frequencies reached the womb. So she would get really animated in the womb when she would hear the string arrangements.
Oh, nice.
That's when she would kick. If you listen carefully in some of the singing, I'm definitely very careful with my notes because, I mean, there was a human body in my womb, so like covering my diaphragm. So it was very challenging. I remember I was watching Beyonce on an award show, and everyone was remarking how incredible it was for her to be singing super pregnant, and I was equally as pregnant at the same time, and I was like, yeah, people just have no idea how hard it is. But, you know, it made the album more special because my inspiration was right there with me in the vocal booth. And when she was born and I played her the songs, I can't describe how I know, but she just remembered the music. It's astounding. And even now when she hears the songs on the radio, she kind of stops and she looks at me and says, hey, that's you, right, Mom? That's you. And she gives me this like look like,
aww,
that's your voice. So
that's beautiful.
It's my way of celebrating this monumental moment in my life, my first Noel.
First Noel.
Because if I have a second kid, he might be a Noel. So, you know, then he'll be my second Noel.
Well, the shepherds did sing. Music from and Conversation with Elizabeth Chan. More with Chan just ahead, including a few more holiday originals. Her most recent release is Songs for Noel. And the song we're about to be hearing about, well, it can have a different feel depending on the format in which it's heard or seen.
Snow is falling down, covering my ground, like a brand new page for me to tell a story about another time, not so long ago. I thought that I had nothing, but I had it all when I was worried about what was under the tree. It left me blind to see the gifts in front of me. And oh, the years go by so fast. I thought that it would last. But now I'm dancing with the ghost of Christmas past. The years go by so fast. I thought that it would last. But now I'm dancing with the ghost of Christmas past.
Also on Songs for Noel, we have Ghost of Christmas Past. Now,
yeah.
This is a tearjerker. At least the video is. I haven't, I admit, listened to the song without having the video in front of me. So, oh my
you
gosh.
You watched the video first.
I did.
Did you have tissues?
Yeah. Beautiful, but sad and hopeful at the same time. Can we talk about this without throwing spoilers out there?
Sure. It's so hard to talk
actually,
about
let's do spoilers.
Video
let's
without
just do it.
The spoilers. And anybody who's listening, you definitely check out the music video on my YouTube page. It's youtube.com/LizChanMusic and look for Ghost of Christmas Past. So the concept of Ghost of Christmas Past was actually very different from the music video that I put out. And
okay, good.
I actually wrote the song just going back to my Christmases past and the things that made them so special. And one of the things was definitely my grandmother And I guess retrospect is 20/20. So when you're a kid, you just don't realize that you have it all. When your family is around you and you're opening up piles and piles of toys, but you just don't realize that that's the time in your life where you have the most family around you, right? Mm-hmm. And as you get older, for whatever reason, you know, like my siblings and I were adults, so we're not all in the same house anymore, and people pass and lives evolve and change, but those memories never go away. And so those become the ghosts of Christmas past. And so the song is just about how, as you're older, sometimes the things you want most at Christmas are just to go back to those ghosts. When I tried to produce a music video with this idea of my grandmother, it was very, very difficult to kind of do that in a very elegant and sincere way. So then I started to think of other stories that could lend itself well to the story that I'm trying to say. Because sometimes, for me, it was my grandmother that I was thinking of, but sometimes for others, it's like loved ones that have gone, that, you know, you just miss so badly during Christmas time, and they don't even have to have passed. It's just like maybe, you know, if you get a divorce and, you know, the family experiences that you've had during a certain time in your life or something that you wistfully look back on.
Sure.
So, you know, I threw around a few story ideas, and I work and direct all my music videos myself as well.
Okay.
So
okay.
I finally came up with this concept for the music video. I don't want to spoil it, but it was very poignant. And, you know, they say to make great art, you have to make people feel. And so I just really wanted to make a video that could just really make people feel. But even without the music video, the response that I get at radio when people hear the song is astounding. You don't need a music video to make that song your own.
Right. Well, with that song, I would imagine some folks listening at this moment are hopefully writing this one down. Do you suggest they listen to the song before watching the video of the song?
I highly suggest they listen to the song first.
Okay.
Before watching the music video, because I think if you watch the music video first, you will always think about the music video.
Yeah.
And I think... Are you speaking from firsthand experience?
I am. I'm trying. After this, I'm going to go listen to it again with and just try to be thinking calm blue ocean, calm ohm, you know, just get it out of there. So. And it's beautiful. Don't get me wrong. You know what I'm saying, though.
It's
sad and poignant.
And it's so funny because I always add elements of my real life and all of my art. And for this music video, I had called upon a friend of mine who was an actor in New York City. And when we were in junior high school, I had the hugest crush on him. And he always liked my best friend. He never liked me. And when it was time to cast for this part in the music video, I had decided to cast him as my boyfriend, just because I could. And so, you know, it was like my own little, you'll see.
Yep. You couldn't wait for the class reunion.
So he's a good sport.
Excellent.
About it. So we're still friends. So it was great to kind of bring him into that. But another really fantastic thing, I don't tell many people about this, but there's a scene in there. I don't know. It's hard for me to say it without telling
people.
Ahead.
Go for it.
But I don't want to spoil it. Okay. So I did the music video before I knew I was pregnant. And the day after I shot the music video, I went to the doctor and I found out I was pregnant. Literally, it was like the day after or like a day or two after. I could not even believe it. I had no idea whatsoever. And a day or two after, the doctor asked if I wanted to take a sonogram. And I was so excited. I was like, absolutely. And the first picture of the sonogram was of an engagement ring type image. And I couldn't believe it. I got goosebumps. It was so crazy. And that's why I added the song on Songs for Noel, because that was her first arrival. It makes sense to you because you've seen the video,
but
I highly suggest everybody go and watch the video and kind of put the pieces together as to what I'm saying.
Listen to it first and then watch it.
Yeah.
Definitely. That was skillfully done, talking about it without actually, you gave us the message behind it without talking about the
card game or arguments or anything. That's great.
You're
That's
giving
great.
Up too much.
I just said a card game. There's a card game. It could be the sting for all they know.
I did a lecture at Syracuse University last week on Thursday. I had played the music video for a lecture hall of 200 students who had never seen the video before. And to hear their response to the music video with the audible gasps and like, like it was so satisfying. So
nice. Good.
As an artist,
good.
I'm quite proud of the song and the music video.
And that reaction. Oh my gosh.
You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Elizabeth Chan, her latest CD release, Songs for Noel.
Santa, I've been good, and I want it all, 'cause I agree the best things in life are free, and there are things you should see when you think of me. Don't I look swell?
Quite somewhere else on the spectrum. Oh, what fun.
Yeah.
We've got also on Songs for Noel. And this is a fun notion behind this. We think of Jingle Bells, Oh, What Fun It Is to Ride. But tell us what this song is and how it came about and what it is now.
Before I decided to put out the record Songs for Noel, the concept for my album was going to be Oh, What Fun. But that was before I was totally inspired by being a first-time mom and then totally changed the concept. Oh, What Fun is really my answer to Santa Baby. There are a few Christmas songs that I would like to challenge myself as a composer to do a different version or a better job in my mind. And I think one of the songs is like Santa Baby. I think it's a great song, but I wanted to make my own. And so, in a way, Oh, What Fun is my Santa Baby.
Santa, are we good? Did you get
It's just a very playful take on the materialistic, like, toys that I would like as an adult. Because I was thinking about, now that I have a child of my own, my Christmases from now until, I don't know, 20, 30 years from now, I'm going to be, like, buying stuff for my daughter, right? Toys for my daughter. So, like, I wanted to add a song on the record that is more of, like, how about toys for me?
Like, you know, cool.
Even though none of the things in the song are anything that I would actually wish for during Christmas, but it was really fun to like kind of take that character in my mind and write from that perspective. I have a lot of friends in New York City. They live this kind of like Sex and the City lifestyle that,
you know,
very materialistic. So I kind of wrote it with my friends in mind. It's my take on Santa Baby.
Good. Well, this is another one that's going to make people go back and listen to one and follow it up with the other, I would hope. This is a quote of yours. I went into your blogs or tweets, but it's, again, you can find a lot of stuff here at lizchanchristmas.com, and this is where I found this stuff. A quote that says simply, I write hundreds of songs a year, and most of them are really bad. So.
Yeah. Seriously, it takes a lot of work to finally come to songs that I know have what it takes to be timeless. Any song that I put out have been songs that I've already written at least a year or two ago. I write tons of music every year, and I have to make sure that they're timeless, and the only way to do that is to kind of leave them be and let them marinate. And if I can recall them several years later without too much prompting, then I know that those are great songs.
Yeah, another really cool quote, actually. Everything starts in your living room, your recorder, and the idea of pigeonholing this, as it were, putting these things away and then coming back later, that is a really great notion in that, again, it talks about the timeliness, that's not the word, the strength of it. It talks about the strength of it, if you can recall it after so much time has passed. Is it usually lyrics first, or do you sometimes even have a melody that you just have to bridge together with words?
Sometimes I'll have a concept of what I want to write, and I will, you know, jot it down or I'll work on it in my head. But honestly, there's no set way in which I compose music. Sometimes I'll be walking on the street or I'll be sitting in a taxi and an idea for a melody will pop into my head and I'll just grab my iPhone and quickly record it. Then I'll bring that melody home and then I'll just start to develop it a little bit more. And some of my best work are the easiest songs to write. So if I'm very inspired by it, I find those are some of the best songs I write. If I am so inspired that I have to run home and finish it, or if I'm working on it on the train or something, you know, like, I was never classically trained as a composer. I never took music theory. I never had classical training in piano or guitar. I taught myself how to play guitar 6 years ago when I started writing Christmas music because it was too hard for me to bring a piano everywhere or a keyboard.
Good point.
So I even took a ukulele. Like, whatever musical instrument I had at my disposal, I would just learn just for the sake of being able to communicate the melody to others. So there's no methodology. I think the only methodology that I have is to just constantly be prolific and constantly write and not be afraid of having writer's block and treating writing Christmas music as a vocation. When I quit my job, I said to myself, well, if you're going to quit your job, you better treat this endeavor as a job. And so I remember the first day of my job as Christmas composer, I woke up, I got dressed for work, I made myself coffee, I commuted to my living room, I sat down at my keyboard, and I told myself that I had to write a Christmas song every day. And for the first 2 years, I wrote a Christmas song every day. And as I got more and more notoriety for my music, I write for half a year now, because the other half of the year is spent marketing, distributing, promoting.
And 730 songs is a bit tedious.
Yeah. No, I love it. I love it. But, you know, Mary Bright Music was born out of a need to formalize a business around all the requests I would get for my music in terms of, like, licensing and placements and stuff. So I see the licensing and the placements as an opportunity, as an avenue to get my Christmas music in a place where people can make it their own. Like, Love Actually took Mariah Carey's song and kind of made it even more visible than it had been in years, right? And so there's always the Christmas movie element. Like, my husband always jokes with me. He wants me to do a version of National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation or something. He wants me to, and I would never do that. But, you know, but that's how some great Christmas songs are made. You know, it's not just, you know, directly from the radio. It can come from anywhere. Or what about that Lexus commercial? Like, I think that that's a very profound Christmas song, like the Lexus Christmas commercial. Mm. Like, that's the same song you hear every year, and there's a familiarity to it, you know?
True.
So half of the year is spent, for me, trying to find a home for these songs that I write that may end up garnering the standard that I so badly want to accomplish in my lifetime, you know?
Something about the holidays. Something about the holidays. Something about the holidays. Something about the holidays. Ooh, I love Christmas. Nothing like Christmas for me. And all the presents, I like them under the tree. Something about the holidays. Something about the holidays.
You mentioned something a bit ago about a lyric or a bit of a melody. Just a notion might hit you in the middle of a taxi or something like that. Give me an example of a phrase that did just hit you and you had to go write it down or stop everything else to flesh this out into a song or at least a complete phrase that you remember. Something that is now recorded, you know?
Yeah, I think the one that sticks out in my mind was I was having a kind of a block of a day and then the phrase, something about the holidays, came into my mind. And it was literally was like a 5-minute song that I wrote, and it just kind of like fell into place, this idea, something about the holidays. I know they're coming, and I can hardly wait. And I think I wrote this in like June or something. So it was like actually very far away. So I think that was a moment where this idea of, I know they're coming, and I can hardly wait. And I was walking around singing that in my house because I was so excited to be writing Christmas music and waiting for the season. So that's one example where I just kind of came up with the concept, and within like 5 minutes I wrote the song.
Cool. You know what? Having read a lot of things at your website by now, I can see that it happening in June. That's not a surprise. You also stated that June 25th, that's halfway to Christmas.
Exactly. I'm one who always celebrates Christmas in July. So
oh, yes.
I often have parties. Like, some companies have their company Christmas party in December, and I think that's very basic. I have mine in July.
Something about the holidays. Merry, merry Christmas. Merry, merry Christmas. Merry, merry Christmas. Merry, merry.
That's music from and conversation with Elizabeth Chan. She has several holiday CDs out, and her sixth and newest, out just this year, is Songs for Noel. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. If a person goes to lizchanchristmas.com, you'll see various things like, say, liner notes. I am a person who reads liner notes and appreciates well-done liner notes, and I'm really disappointed if there aren't any. It goes beyond wanting to know if it's Ray Brown on bass, you know?
Yeah.
There's a real art form to the liner note that you've shared online.
Well, you know, it takes a village to raise a Christmas song, and I would be remiss to not mention all of the wonderful musicians and the people that it takes for me to even be where I am today. It looks like it's just me, but it's really dozens and dozens of people who have been by my side from the very beginning, you know, who have supported me in different capacities, whether it's like, well, my husband, for one, from the very beginning, when I told him I was going to quit my job, he was the only one that said, okay, like, I think you can do this. I mean, I just want you to be happy. Like, how many husbands really say that? Like, I just want you to be happy and actually mean it. Like, I swear, my husband is a saint. He actually meant it.
Wow.
So,
you read about this kind of thing.
He had no idea that I was actually going to have success in this. Success to him was just to see me happy. So he, for one, is someone who has been a huge part of my journey, and he also helps me design my album covers and the liner notes as well, even designing the fonts and everything. So from him to the musicians that I work with this great guy named Dave Agar, and he's a world-class cellist that I've worked with for several years, to my makeup artist who's on every shoot with me for every music video. I mean, like, the team can go on and on and on, and so for me, it's very important to give them credit where credit is due. And I feel that people don't give people credit in the music industry anymore. They don't give the credit that people deserve when people help you support your dream. It's very important for me to kind of pay homage to the people that help you get there, because no one can get there on their own. No one.
Just a couple things before we wrap. I have to hear about Christmas in the City. This is a love song, but it's not to a person.
It's to the city that had raised me, and I'm so happy to say that I am calling from the city right now. You know, I grew up in New York City, the best Christmas city in the world. There's nothing like it between the tree at Rockefeller Center, the UNICEF snowflake on 57th Street, Central Park, horse-drawn carriages. I can go on and on. There's something about New York City that just illuminates during the Christmas season. And so I feel so fortunate to have been raised here. And so I wrote a love song to the city that I grew up in. And also, when I was a kid, my love for Christmas music came from a local radio station here that would flip to all Christmas on Thanksgiving. You know, I would never shut the radio off from that day until Christmas Day. So Christmas in the City is my homage to the city that raised me to love Christmas so much. I'm very, very lucky to say that Christmas in the City is actually somewhat of a standard in New York City. It plays every year in the local radio stations here, so I'm so proud of that song because I just mean it wholeheartedly. Someone asked me, what's the main ingredient that you need in great Christmas music?
Yes.
You really need to approach Christmas music with so much sincerity and authenticity when you tell your story, because if you don't have it, people can tell.
Despite Mary Bright's mission of releasing holiday music, surely you have non-holiday songs pigeonholed somewhere.
technically, I covered one song. And this is for Noel. I covered an Arcade Fire song that I added on Songs for Noel. Yeah, I did my version of a very well-known rock song for her because I like the message. As a new mom, and if I could impart like a life lesson to my daughter, it was pretty well encompassed in that song, so I just wanted to make a version of it for her. That's why I called it Songs for Noel. Every song on the album, I really had her in mind and songs that I wanted to leave for her. So that's one of them. I grew up across the street from Ground Zero my entire life. And so on the 15th anniversary of September 11th, I released a September 11th song called Concrete Tears. And it actually is part of the permanent collection in the 9/11 Museum. So those are the only two non-holiday songs, although one might argue that the September 11th song is not a holiday per se, but you know what I mean, like it's tied to a moment.
Yes. One more thing, I suppose. Throughout this conversation, anytime I ought to say CD, I often inadvertently say album. So with vinyl having made quite the comeback, how about you? Are you tempted by this at all? Large art on photos, easy to read liner notes?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I'm not because people don't buy Christmas vinyl.
Oh, like, good point. Okay, yeah.
People are now grabbing Christmas playlists off of, like, Spotify, or they're streaming stuff, or they're listening to their local Christmas radio station on their iPhone. So there's only one of me, and there's only so much that I can do, and I just want to be around the ears of as many people as possible during the Christmas season because I only have 60 days. I'm like Santa Claus. People don't really care until, like, November. In the United States, people don't care until November. In the Philippines, they care around September. But even still, I'm saying my runway is a little short. So I just want to be in as many homes and be part of as many holiday festivities and memories as possible. And so if I focused on vinyl, that might take me away from focusing on other aspects, you know?
True.
It's a great place for liner notes, though. I agree.
Oh, fact. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Elizabeth, I'm just very happy that you're doing what you're doing, and it really sounds like you're a real success story as well. And I'm excited to be able to share your music and a bit of your story.
Well, thank you. And I'm humbled and always thankful for those who help me share the music and my story, because it's very important.
That's music from and conversation with Elizabeth Chan. Her latest release is Songs for Noel, inspired by and named for her daughter. More on Elizabeth at lizchanchristmas.com, also more at marybrightmusic.com. And that's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks once again to Elizabeth Chan and again to Larry Burns, author of 100 Things to Do in Riverside, California Before You Die. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Jessica Greenwell, and Mike Pesavento. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, Behind Us Now, For Example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.